everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. The topic, The Physics of Angels, a postmodern dialogue between science and spirituality. Two guests. Dr. Rupert Sheldrake is a British biochemist and a plant physiologist who has experimented with innovative fields of plants and animals, including humans, to account for the causative formation of the deeper structures of biological development and collective consciousness. His research included efforts to reach a greater understanding of memory, perception, and cognition, as well as the forces that unfold an organism. Over the past several decades, Rupert developed his theory of morphic resonance and morphogenic fields. While in India, he became a close associate of the late Father Griffiths, an internationally renowned Dominican monk, mystic, and spokesperson for interspiritual dialogue between religions. Dr. Sheldrake has written extensively on morphogenic theory since the publication of A New Science in Life in 1981. His book, Science Set Free, is a thorough critique of the flaws in the dominant mechanistic scientific model. His website is sheldrake.org. He is joined by Reverend Matthew Fox, one of today's most progressive theologians and spiritual visionaries. He is the founding theologian behind what is called creation spirituality, an ecumenical and interspiritual theology that posits life as an original blessing. For years, former Pope Benedict, then known as Cardinal Ratzinger, the chief inquisitor and head of the Vatican's Congregation of Doctrine and Faith, attempted to silence Reverend Fox, which eventually led to his being expelled from the Dominican Order and his subsequent joining the Anglican Church. Later, he followed with his efforts to found Yalawi, an inner-city project in Oakland, California, to bring youth together with elders for learning and wisdom. He is the author of over 30 books on theology and biblical history and mysticism, interfaith dialogue, education, gender issues, cosmology, and other topics, including the Pope's War and the Hidden Spirituality of Men. His website is matthewfox.org. Nice to have you both with us today.
Thank you, Gary. Good to be with you both.
Yes, thanks.
I'd like to begin our conversation with something you both share in common in your respective fields. That is, you both have numerous critics and are regarded by many as heretics and mavericks. Some critics go as far as to suggest you should be silenced and your views condemned. Of course, there is nothing new in these kind of attacks on scientists, philosophers, mystics, and visionaries who go against the grain and promote a mode of thinking or forward insights contrary to the official word of the ruling establishment. So obviously bringing up other worldly entities, such as angels, as a subject worthy of discussion, both in modern religion and in science, will stir strong opposition in the so-called professional fields. In their mind, how can modern people today, who should be placing their faith in science, possibly believe in the existence of ethereal beings? On the other hand, polls indicate that the majority of people do believe in ethereal beings or angels. Up to 77% of adults, according to an Associated Press survey, believe in them. The percentage is 88% among Christians, even higher for evangelical Christians. And women believe in angels more readily than men. So with these figures and the widespread belief in angels and other ethereal entities, which are not limited to Christianity, but are found in all religious traditions, is there such reluctance to further explore and investigate their existence and purpose? And why is the scientific community so reticent and oppositional towards people and individuals such as yourselves who posit their existence and importance? I'd like each of you to address this question in turn. And we'll begin with you, Dr. Sheldrake.
Well, the context for the controversy that, as you rightly point out, exists over this is the dogmatic belief of many scientists that we live in a universe that's completely material. It's called the materialist worldview. And a material universe which is made of unconscious matter. The only forms of consciousness they admit are in human brains or higher animals. Possibly liberal materialists would say in lower animals too. But otherwise, the rest of the universe is thought to be unconscious. So there's absolutely no room for angels or spirits or any other form of intelligent entity in this universe. So suggesting that such beings exist is clearly upsetting and heretical or even nonsensical from a mechanistic point of view. But the reason, so that's the reason people get upset. Some people have put their entire faith in this worldview, which I critique in my book, Science Set Free. But the key issue really is the nature of consciousness and where consciousness is located in the universe, what kinds of consciousness there are. The assumption that the whole of the universe is unconscious except for us and possibly little green men or extraterrestrials on other planets is that. It's an assumption. It's never been proved. It's simply taken for granted by many scientists. But it's not as if science has been brilliantly successful in explaining the nature of consciousness. Even our own consciousness is profoundly mysterious. In the philosophy of mind, it's called the hard problem, because no one knows how an entirely unconscious universe could produce conscious beings such as ourselves. So consciousness is a big problem for science as it stands. Even ordinary, even our own everyday consciousness, even the fact we're conscious right now, that's not explained. So it's not as if science has figured it all out and this is some ridiculous superstition. We don't know the nature of consciousness, and in my view, consciousness may exist in many, many forms. It may exist in many kinds of animals. Some people in the philosophy of panpsychism think even some kind of mental activity is present in electrons, atoms, and molecules. And large entities like the sun and the galaxy and stars in general may have minds. They may be conscious, in which case there may be many kinds of consciousness beyond our level, higher forms of consciousness than our own within the universe. And that's exactly what people in the Middle Ages and in all cultures throughout the world have believed, that there are other forms of consciousness beyond our own, not just divine consciousness and human consciousness with nothing in between, but many other kinds of consciousness. And in the West, they're traditionally called angels. And so that's the context in which Matthew Fox and I have been exploring the possibility of other kinds of consciousness and how this might relate to the traditions from the Jewish and the Christian tradition, the traditions we've inherited in the West.
I appreciate that overview. Let's follow that up, because there is an interest by some in looking at your views of astro and biophysics, quantum physics, strengthening and informing us about the existence and roles of angels and their interactions with humans. Could you explore that, please?
Well, the main way in which angels would interact with us, well, I mean, there are several ways. First of all, they could interact through our minds, through either through communicating with us directly in a way we might hear them as speaking. We might see them, and in fact, in the biblical accounts of angels, many of them appear to people in dreams and as visions. So that's a communication through minds. Sometimes people feel that angels are intervening in their lives through events, through averting accidents, or through causing other people to do things, or in intervening in the course of nature. So that's another way in which they can interact with us. And I think that some kinds of angels, the ones that are basically involved in governing galaxies and stars, may not interact with us very much, but they may interact a lot with the natural realm. And indeed, the traditional doctrines of angels in the West, which we discuss in our book, The Physics of Angels, see them as guiding not just humans, but nature as well. They're a key part in the intelligent organization of the natural realm.
Thomas Aquinas, the great 13th century theologian whose work we rely on in part in this book, he says that angels learn only through intuition. and that's why they don't have schools or read books or write books and so forth. But what this means to me is that when humans get into their intuition in a deep way, you are very likely to run into angels. In fact, we have a special word for that in our language called muse. A muse is an inspiration, an inspiring presence during our creative activity. And this is why so many painters will paint angels, I think, and so many musicians and others will talk about encountering angels and spirits in their work, including, of course, in ritual, the art of ritual. For example, in the Native American tradition, it's just taken for granted that you encounter the spirits in the sweat lodge or in a sun dance and in other ceremonies. And so ritual or worship or liturgy is very important to these beings of great consciousness because they want to praise. They want to be happy and make us happy. Aquinas says an angel cannot help but love. And so the whole dimension of love and intuition and creativity are what I call the highways where you will pick up hitchhiking angels. Now, there's a woman alive today named Lorna Byrne, B-Y-R-N-E, who's an Irish peasant. And from the time she was 2 years old, she has been seeing and talking with angels. They told her not to tell anyone until they let her do so, and that was only 5 years ago. She's now 61 years old, the grandmother and so forth. She's also illiterate. But she's had these encounters with angels throughout her life. She says that today there are many, many unemployed angels on the planet. What is an unemployed angel? She says, when humans get in trouble, such as we're in today in a deep way, God pours angels on the earth to assist humans, to raise our consciousness, you see. And she says, God is pouring angels on the earth today, but no one's asking them for help. At least not many people are. And so there are a lot of unemployed angels. And then Hildegard of Bingen, the great 12th century Benedictine abbess and mystic, whom we also treat in this book on Physics of Angels, she also says that angels admire human work. They love to applaud and to praise our work. And I think that's an important dimension, too, of where angels and humans intersect. It has to do with our work, what we're giving back to the world.
Okay, Matt, we need something more primary to begin this, however, because countless people throughout the world, many of that you've just mentioned, have described experiences or encounters with an otherworldly presence, which is not simply the visitation of a relative or family member who has passed away or a ghost inhabiting a haunted house. That's what we see on television. They perceive these presences as more otherworldly and fundamentally different, even ontologically diverse from ourselves. However, people are, for the most part, unable to define who or what these entities or angels are, what their role and function is, where their place in the cosmos lies, or what relationship they might have to human life that would account for their personal encounters with these beings. So, Matt, what do the old cosmologies, as the very elaborate cosmology of the late Christian Neoplatonists, talk about? How to offer us an explanation of the existence of these other dimensions and their relevance to our postmodern lives?
Well, of course, the word angel in Greek means messenger. And I think, therefore, one of the main purposes of angels is to bring information to awaken us as messengers from, as you say, other worlds. And as Rupert was talking about, some angels have very important governing roles to play in terms of the unfolding of evolution. And now that we live in a world that we know is evolutionary, this opens up whole venues and possibilities for how angels act upon our lives. It's not just something like helping us across the street, although that kind of personal attention and protection the work of some kinds of angels, but that angels operate in terms of the of the intelligent unfolding of the universe. One of the lessons I've learned from dialoguing with Rupert and the stories in our book is that Charles Darwin's close scientific companion named Wallace, who helped him develop the theory of evolution, the two of them split over the subject of angels. Darwin said evolution was entirely by chance and survival of the fittest, and Wallace said, no, there's too much intelligence in this, too much purpose, and therefore there must have been guiding intelligences, and that's what we call angels. So Rupert can go further into that story, but I think it's a very interesting story. We all know Darwin's name. No one knows Wallace's name. He did not have the PR team that Darwin had. He was just a scientist, after all. So I think that's very interesting, too, that early in the scientific telling of the story of evolution, there was this split around the work of angels or versus the work of chance alone. And I think that's very significant. And I think that argument, you might say, is still going on within science, but also even within religion.
Okay, then let's follow up with you, Rupert. Since both of you believe that the subject of angels is relevant again and that it's a part of a new phase in the dialogue between science and theology that's emerging, please explain why you feel this is the case, and in particular the intersection or overlap between the new cosmological theories and insights and then the older, more metaphysical cosmologies that include different dimensions and states of being besides the human material world. And I feel that for most people, it would be difficult for them to perceive that the connections between science and spirituality might be strengthened by engaging in a conversation about angels. So from the perspective of a scientist, how do you feel theology is contributing to your profession in this dialogue? And then after that, from Matt, I would like to hear how you feel science is contributing to theology and spirituality.
Well, it comes back to this point about consciousness in the universe. The big challenge for science at the moment is understanding the nature of minds, the nature of consciousness. I would say it's probably the most important challenge in the scientific world. In the 17th century, the scientific revolution that gave us modern science was based on the idea that the universe is a machine without any purpose or direction. They thought it was a machine made by God in the first place, but then running more or less automatically. And that's been the worldview we've inherited, and that's the worldview still built into the foundations of science, as I discuss in my book, The Science Set Free. So in a machine universe, there's no space for angels. There's no space for any other consciousness. There's no space for spirits, because everything's just working mechanically. Now, there's absolutely no reason why scientists working within that worldview should even waste 1 second on talking about angels. They just see it as complete nonsense or superstition. But in the context where one of the great challenges for science is coming to terms with consciousness, what we're seeing at the moment is a shift among philosophy and philosophers and scientists towards a position called panpsychism. Panpsychism is the idea there's a kind of mind at many levels of organization in nature. The leading panpsychist philosophers at the moment are Galen Strawson, who's a philosopher of mind, and Thomas Nagel in New York at Columbia. Both of whom in recent years have come out of mainstream materialist philosophy and declared that they actually don't think it'll work anymore. We need panpsychism to explain human consciousness. Unless consciousness is present throughout nature, then the appearance of consciousness just in humans is a kind of miracle, which isn't a very scientific position. Interestingly, the neuroscientist Christoph Koch, who was a pretty hard-nosed materialist, worked with Francis Crick, just a few months ago wrote an article in Scientific American coming out for panpsychism, as suggesting there's a kind of consciousness even in electrons. This is now a serious debate within the scientific and philosophical world. Now, if we're having a debate about within science about consciousness at beyond the human level and below the human level, this is an area where traditional science has nothing whatever to say, since it's ignored consciousness altogether. But it's something which was thought about by theologians and by pre-mechanistic metaphysical philosophers. So instead of reinventing the wheel, one thing we can do is actually look at what people have already thought about along these lines. And in that sense, theology is, I think, very relevant, because it has something to... It's primarily about consciousness, because after all, God is nothing if not conscious. And so we have a long tradition of discussion of the nature of the mind of God and the nature of the minds of the many different kinds of intelligence or conscious being in the universe. That's something theology has to tell, has something to say about, but which science has nothing to say about. And as we move from a mechanistic materialist model in science towards a post-materialist, post-mechanistic view of nature, the big item on the agenda is consciousness. How does it work? What does it do? What sense does it make to say that an electron might be conscious, or that the sun might be conscious? If they're conscious, what do they think about? And what role could their thoughts have in our lives, and how could their minds be related to our mind? These are actually matters of quite considerable interest within contemporary philosophy of mind and science.
I appreciate those insights. I'd like to have you go a step further, please. You've observed parallels between the theologian Thomas Aquinas that Matt mentioned earlier and his angelology in the Middle Ages and Albert Einstein's view of photons. Could you explain this further?
Yes, it's a particularly interesting point, because that's the reason we called the book The Physics of Angels, actually, because when we read this passage in St. Thomas Aquinas, where he's discussing the nature of angels, at one point he's talking about how angels move. They need to move because they can act in one place and then they can act in another place, so they must move from one place to another, unless they're always in the same place. So being very logical and rational, and that's the impressive thing about medieval theology, particularly the theology of Aquinas, is that it's extremely rational, much more rational than many contemporary atheists who sort of go into emotional polemics at the slightest provocation. It's very rational, and he's talking about how if they move from one place to another, when they get to another place, how we know they're there. Well, we know they're there because they act. They have an action. And then he discusses how when an angel acts, it can't act with part of its being. It acts with all of its being, or none of its being. So it has to have a full quantum of action. So it's basically a quantum of action. An angel is a quantum of action. It acts as a whole. You can't have a bit of it acting. And when it acts, moves from one place where it's been acting to another place where it acts, then as far as the angel's concerned, no time elapses as it's undergoing that journey from one place to another. But from the point of view of an external observer, this would take time. And this is particularly interesting, you see, because when Einstein's discussing photons, he did this thought experiment when he was quite young, which formed the foundation for a lot of his relativity theory. The thought experiment was, he imagines himself running along beside a photon of light traveling at the speed of light. They imagine sort of jumping onto the photon and traveling with the photon. And from the point of view of the photon, no time elapses when it moves from one place to another. But from the point of view of an external observer, it's traveling at a speed, the speed of light. And the other thing about it is that when it arrives in one place, it acts as a whole. It can't act as a part. In fact, the very word quantum in quantum theory means quantum of action. That's what a quantum is. It's a quantum of action. And we know about quanta because of their action, and we know about them because the whole quantum acts. from the point of view of the quantum, as it moves from one place to another, a photon of light, there's no time involved, but when, for the external observer, there is. So you see, there's an almost exact parallel between this discussion in Aquinas, in medieval angelology, and one of the key discussions or positions in relativity physics. And that's very striking, and I think the parallel arises because if you think of beings that have no mass, photons have no mass, and angels have no mass, if you think of beings which have no mass moving from one place to another and acting as a whole, then you do indeed come up with something very like that. There's a sense in which this discussion of Aquinas anticipates some aspects of quantum theory many centuries earlier.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Matt, during the time that both of you proceeded in this dialogue and conversation about angels with each other, have either of you discovered you had personal experiences with ethereal agencies that contributed to your investigations in this matter? And could you give us some insight?
Well, I have had some experiences with angels, and I know a lot of people who have. Often when I'm giving a lecture, I'll have people shut their eyes and so they're not in competition, and just ask how many of you believe you have encountered angels in your life or someone close to you whom you really trust has. And as a rule, about 80 or 85% of the hands go up. So this is something you spoke to earlier, Gary, when you had some statistics about the percentage of Americans who believe in angels. But if you go around the world, I think you'll find that even a higher percentage of people in indigenous cultures believe in spirits or angels, and they have these experiences. I've had them during worship. In fact, I did a Sundance this summer, and there were 15 spirits up in a tree smiling at us for a lot of the time we were praying. And I've had encounters with angels, I think, and I think we all have them in our dreams, as Rupert alluded to. I often wake up 2 or 3 in the morning with ideas. Thomas Aquinas says, angels carry thoughts from prophet to prophet. And I love that phrase. To me, it conjures up the image of a bee carrying nectar from flower to flower. And I think that our thoughts, again, we capture this in the word muse, that our thoughts do come from other places and other consciousnesses, and that there is a community of conscious beings, and angels are certainly part of that community. And all of us, again, when we tap into our creativity, into our capacity for love and for birthing, I think we encounter angels. And you asked earlier about why science is so important for theology, and to me it's obvious. Again, I come from Thomas Aquinas' tradition. I'm a Dominican, or I was for 34 years, as well as Aquinas, and he says that a mistake about nature results in a mistake about God. It's an very, very important sentence, because if a mistake about nature results in a mistake about God, then it seems to me an insight about nature would result in an insight about God. And that's why you need science. And Thomas Aquinas wrote 10 books on Aristotle, the greatest scientist that the Middle Ages could unearth. And, of course, he came to Europe through Islam. It was in Baghdad itself that Muslims were translating Aristotle into many languages, including Latin. And so this is how Aristotle came to Europe. And it was Aquinas who, more than anyone else, who picked up on Aristotle. And he was harassed for it. He was even condemned for it 3 times before they canonized him a saint, because the fundamentalists then, just like today, were saying, who needs science? We've got all the answers in the Bible. But Aquinas says, no, we have to know what nature is about if we're going to really know what God is about. And then you have a contemporary scientist, now deceased, but one of the launchers of postmodern science, Eric Jantsch, his important book, Self-Organizing Universe, he ends it by saying God is the mind of the universe. Now, this is what Rupert's talking about, I think, when he talks about consciousness. that where there is consciousness, there is a presence of the divine. And of course, in the Eastern tradition, and too in the Western religious tradition, consciousness precedes the creation itself. The Bible says that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word spoke, and creation unfolded. But again, these are stories to talk about how consciousness permeates. Consciousness begins the universe and permeates the universe, and we all partake of it. Hildegard of Bingen, this great 12th century scientist and mystic and musician and so forth, she says that no creature lacks an interior life. So she would definitely be on the side of those scientists today who are debating, as Rupert says, about where is consciousness. She would say a stone has consciousness. Every being, every atom has a certain kind of interior life, and that is consciousness.
If you've just joined us, I'm Gary Noll. Joining me today on our Progressive Commentary Hour, our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, The Physics of Angels, a Postmodern Dialogue Between Science and Spirituality, and Dr. Rupert Sheldrake from England, and Reverend Matthew Fox, who's in Oakland, California. Gentlemen, I'd like to shift the gears slightly here, and that's because both of you have written and discussed extensively on the issues of arguments that a higher level of realization and awakening is critical and urgently needed if humanity is going to get through the destructive threats it faces, and these challenges are now too numerous to list. Unfortunately, the powers that are leading the planet towards environmental catastrophes, more wars and conflicts, a debt-enslaved society, and philosophically towards materialistic, reductionistic views of the world and human life are extremely well-organized and well-funded. Our shots over the bow seem like rubber pellets in comparison. However, we have the new sciences providing strength to deconstruct deterministic scientific beliefs. On the social side, we have morals and ethics of human rights and compassion that have been the pinnacle of peaceful societies that have flourished in the past. And we have newer expressions of spirituality still based upon the older classical spiritual traditions and psychology to deconstruct religious literalism and irrational beliefs. Nevertheless, I sometimes question how successful this has been. So I'd like you each to speak on how the dialogue between science and spirituality, with the inclusion of higher moral values, can better awaken people up to the environmental and social threats we face, and how this might also, if framed properly within a higher code of ethics, can counter powers that are guiding us towards self-destruction. Dr. Sheldrake, we'll begin with you, please.
Okay. Well, I think the key thing here is that the changes that are happening in the sciences at the moment are changes that are moving us beyond old-style mechanistic reductionism towards a view of nature as much more interconnected. There are various ways in which that's happening, partly through quantum physics, which has these interconnections at a distance called quantum non-locality or entanglement. Those were very surprising to people within science because they show mysterious connections now being applied in quantum computing that Einstein called spooky action at a distance. The second thing that emphasizes interconnection is field theories, and these are not so new in science. They started with Faraday in the 19th century. But what field theories tell us is that things are invisibly interconnected. Science isn't just about hard, measurable stuff. The fields that keep the whole universe together, the universal gravitational field that binds the entire universe together, it makes it one thing, one universe, including the whole universe. This is a field, an invisible structure. The electromagnetic fields of the universe connect everything in it. That's why with radio telescopes and the Hubble Space Telescope, we can see light and radio waves from some of the very earliest events in the universe, why we can see distant galaxies billions of light years away, because the light travels across the whole universe. How? Through the electromagnetic field that fills the whole universe. And in Gaia theory, we have the idea of the Earth as a living organism, that our life is connected to the life of our planet. And without the healthy life of our planet, there can be no human life. Now, these are relatively recent realizations within the sciences. And I think there are more on the way. I mean, one of the things I work on is telepathy and the way that people's minds can be connected through intention. Also, collective memory, the way in which we all draw upon a kind of collective memory and in turn contribute to it. All of these things are invisible. And the interesting thing about modern science is what it does is explains the visible in terms of the invisible. It's completely the opposite of what people might expect in a kind of naive way, that it's all about hard facts, meaning sort of stuff you can push around and stuff. It isn't. Most of it, as soon as you start to explain anything in terms of modern science, even solid objects like tables and chairs become seen as made up of mainly space held together by fields and invisible interactions. So when we realize that our lives are interconnected with everything else, our economy is interconnected with the ecology, our conscious minds are connected with minds not only of each other people, but of many levels of consciousness within the universe. This has ethical implications. It's not just about us as individuals earning as much as we can and spending as much as we can on ourselves and our families for our own good alone. The ethical implication is that we're not separate from other people and from the rest of nature, and we have to behave in a way that's in accordance with that. Now, we can arrive at this through a scientific understanding of interconnectedness, and all the sciences at the moment are moving towards this much greater sense of interconnectedness. It's also, of course, a basic spiritual insight. I went on a very fascinating conference several years ago. It was around the Black Sea. It was convened by the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, who is the titular head of the Orthodox Churches. And it was also convened by the European Union Commissioner for the Environment. And it was about religion, science, and the environment. So we had scientists and theologians, and there were rabbis, and there were imams, and people from different religions, and different Roman Catholics, Anglicans, as well as some atheists, discussing the ethics, as well as the practical measures that we need to do something about the environment. And in particular, the Black Sea at that stage was extremely polluted, and we were focusing on marine biology and the environment of the Black Sea. Towards the end of that conference, the Ecumenical Patriarch was joined by the Patriarch of Georgia, the Patriarch of Romania, the Patriarch of Bulgaria. We had a meeting with the Patriarch of Moscow and all Russia. And these Orthodox patriarchs came out with a statement saying that that the Spirit of God is the life, the breath of life in all nature. The Orthodox Church has a very wide conception of the Spirit of God as the life of nature, not just something that works through people or speaks through prophets and so on, but as the life of nature. And a sin against the environment is a sin against the Spirit. And that's what they came up with. And it was a very, very broad view that gave a new understanding of this basic theological principle in an ethical dimension in relation to the pollution of the environment and our duty to preserve the environment that we've inherited through no effort of our own. It's freely given to us, and we have a duty towards it. So that, for me, was a particularly clear focusing of science, religion, the environment, and ethics, bringing them together through the terrible things that we've been doing to the environment of the world.
Thank you for those insights.
I'd certainly like to
please
bring in on this,
that
too. I really like the stories there that Rupert laid out. I want to back up to this theme of interconnectivity and interdependence, because to me that is the very basis of the meaning of compassion. Thomas Merton, the great Catholic monk who was writing in the 60s and died in 1968, his last talk he gave just before he died,
he said that compassion is a keen awareness of the interdependence of all things that are all part of one another and involved in one another. Well, now that insight, of course, came from his contemplative and spiritual experience and tradition. And now we have scientists, and Rupert is a good example, 50 years later, saying exactly this, that all beings are interdependent. And therefore, we're now getting a scientific basis for compassion. And it's not a religious base. It doesn't have to be an exclusively religious basis. But this is where religion and science can come together. The Dalai Lama says we can do away with all religion, but we can't do away with compassion. Compassion is my religion, he says. Well, if you look deeply at all the spiritual traditions of the world, which I've certainly tried to do over the years, you find this is at the heart of all religious teaching. In the Jewish tradition, compassion is the secret name for God. And Jesus, being Jewish, in Luke's Gospel, chapter 6, says, "Be you compassionate as your Creator in heaven is compassionate." So he kind of is letting this secret out. He's broadcasting it and democratizing it. And in the Quran, without any question, the most frequently used name for Allah is Allah, the Compassionate One. And so you have this teaching, East and West, in all the world's spiritual traditions, that the heart of the matter is compassion. Now, I think if you look at it scientifically, if you consider that we have, each of us has three brains, the reptilian brain, 420 million years old in us, the mammal brain, 210 million years old, and then the much more recent cognitive brain. The mammal brain is really the compassionate brain, because mammals have a real sense of family and kinship and caring, more so than do most reptiles. And so this is interesting that in both Hebrew and in Arabic, the word for compassion comes from the word for womb. The womb people, the mammals, are the carriers of compassion. So I think that scientifically speaking and ethically speaking, we have to say we have to arouse the mammal brain today and to take action. Currently, so much of human action is based on the reptilian brain. It's action-reaction. Look at Bush and Cheney going to war in Iraq after 9/11. That was a reptilian brain response. It was a reaction, but it certainly was not compassionate, and it didn't even pass through the test of cognition. So there are so many ways in which science and ethics can connect today. The sense of the sacred, this is really what the cosmic theology of the Eastern Christian churches that Rupert's talking about, where this comes forward, and this is what the creation spiritual tradition is all about, that every being is sacred. That means every being has its rights. And Meister Eckhart, the great 14th century mystic, said, isness is God. Every being is holy. He says every creature is a word of God and a book about God. So it's a sense of the sacred that we've lost as a species. And we have to recover that sense, and then we'll be in a place where we can, we will adapt our lifestyle so that future generations can live healthily amidst the beauty and the health of this planet. Another issue is apathy. Lester Brown, who's a real ecological prophet, has said that the number one obstacle to environmental revolution is apathy. And apathy is a lack of energy to begin new things. It's what Aquinas talked about as acedia. So getting the energy going, and by energy I include movements, I include processions, I include the Occupy movement sitting in front of Wall Street and saying that Wall Street is acting immorally, and we cannot turn economics over to the banksters of Wall Street. Main Street needs more attention. And there's so many ways then in which the sense of the sacred gets aroused when you are aware of what we could be doing in terms of climate change, for example, in terms of encouraging the creativity that that we have to develop alternative ways of energy that are truly clean and recyclable. And finally, there's this marvelous happening that happened this year thanks to science and technology, and that was the satellite that we launched 12 years ago, was leaving our solar system, the first time ever that humans have launched something that left our solar system. And looking back, it took a picture of its journey. And we have these pictures, you can go on YouTube and see them, and it looks like a bunch of dots, light dots in the background, and the scientists have one arrow pointing to one dot, and that dot is the Earth. I think this is a new icon, a new image, just like 45 years ago we got the icon of the Earth as a whole, taken by the astronauts. This icon puts Earth into perspective and context. This particular dot we're living on is very minuscule and very fragile and very special. And if every human being, whether you're atheist or Christian or Jewish or Muslim or anything else, if every human being cannot get turned on by that icon and realize that all this ridiculous amount of money we put into war, we're spending $56,000 a second on war as a species today, this is ridiculous. It's pure reptilian brain energy. We have to say no to that nonsense and gather around preserving this dot that is so special, and with it, our species and the many other beautiful species we share the planet with can survive. That's what ethics is about. It's about survival.
Matt, I just have time for one more question to each of you, and I'll begin with you. Recently, there's been a flurry of articles and studies and op-eds addressing the collapse of critical thinking among Americans, something you just mentioned. And this is not just among the average citizenry, but among those in power, our legislators, lobbyists, lawyers, financiers, and educators. If people are unable to think critically, they are unable to make informed choices to vote on. They're unable to rationalize and see through the illusions our media dumps upon us, nor to discern the truth or falsehoods in the news. They're unable to question a doctor's diagnosis intelligently. Basically, they're unable to formulate any coherent sense of deeper meaning in their lives, and nor devote themselves to a greater purpose other than struggling to survive, numbing themselves in mindless entertainment and dreaming they can climb the ladder of Big Brother's food chain. So take us one step further and let us see how we can turn this around. What do you see as being the long-term consequences of an even more dumbed-down population, and what must we do to change it?
Well, I think we have an economic system, including the media for the most part, that runs on rendering citizens passive. In fact, our passivity is so prevalent today that we've invented a new word for it in our vocabulary, and that is couch potato-itis, being passive. And I think that consumer capitalism wants us to be passive. They want us sitting on our couches, eating their potato chips and drinking their Coke and watching their television programs ad infinitum until we die. And I think that is their goal, to stuff us with as much of their goodies as possible so they make as much money as they can for themselves and their shareholders. And we have to rebel against this. And it's natural to rebel against it. It's, to be a couch potato is not natural because it's not fun. It's not exciting. It's not adventurous. It doesn't feed our curiosity. Whereas a truly critical living and critical ways with thinking does do that. Now, I say academia is involved in the same problem, I think. It's I would call it a military-industrial prison academic complex that's happening. And I think academia has to die. I think all these institutions, I think Wall Street has to die. I think all these institutions have to give way to something that is more global and that is more respectful and more in tune with the sacredness of existence itself. And I think that education needs a complete rehauling, beginning with the values. Now, it's interesting to me that Einstein himself said that values do not come from the intellect. He said they come from intuition and from feeling, which are the same thing, he said. Now, again, we've been talking about angels and how angels operate with intuition. And I think that another word for intuition is mysticism. We have to recharge our capacity for experiences of unity, and that's what mysticism is. And, of course, this expanded sense of fields that Rupert talks about, the new science is talking about, is about our unity with other beings. And to awaken this experience of unity is, I think, to flood out some of the illusory doctrines, dogmas, Rupert calls them, that we've been given not just through science but through our materialistic culture. Because I think that that capitalism, as it is conceived today, has latched on to this scientific materialism and has said, well, there's no other meaning in life. Why not making the infinite amount of money be your meaning in life? And or eating an infinite amount of potato chips. So I think that, you know, no religion in the world has ever countenanced the idea that greed or avarice is good for the human soul or good for the human community. And yet that is how our economic system essentially runs, not just on the avarice of the Wall Street winners, but also the avarice of the individual person who wants to consume more and more and more of every year's new version of styles and cars and refrigerators and everything else. This is where I think a prophetic voice has to rise in all of us and say, no, life is more precious, life is more sacred and more mysterious than this rain, this flood of material goodies is proposing to us. It's a distortion of the human existence, of our souls, and of the earth itself, because humans are destroying the earth because we're so narcissistic, so stuck in our own tiny worlds of defining what pleasure is and isn't.
Thank you. And finally, Dr. Sheldrake, recently there had been a lot of people talking about, in the progressive movements, how we can empower each other, how we can become wiser, to shed our fears and to act upon our convictions and conscience in order to become more actively involved with causes and organizations that we feel drawn to and dedicate ourselves to improving the state of the world rather than to tearing it down. But most people are paralyzed by fears or the dread of the future, or they can't get beyond their disbelief that things are as bad as they are. And you have had to deal with this on a personal level, where you have been challenged by many who do not understand you or don't think deeply enough or are fearful themselves. They're afraid of you. They're afraid of what you and Matthew Fox and others are saying. I'd like you to share any life experiences or realizations that were particularly important in providing insight and wisdom as to how you got beyond the illusions that limited you to become more vital in social, political, and environmental causes.
Well, I think that if we just look at what's out there and what's happening in the world, it's very easy to feel disempowered. But this is where angels come in again. In our book, The Physics of Angels, we discuss many aspects of angels, but one aspect that for me is an important one is prayer. You can actually ask the angels to help. And I do. I mean, as I'm sitting now in my study in London, on the wall I have a bas relief from an ancient Coptic bas relief of the Archangel Michael. And I asked Michael to help me and the other angels. And Michael was involved in a great struggle. In the Bible, we read about this struggle that Michael was fighting against, these powers of destruction. The powers of destruction are based on the principle of deceit, and they're based on the principle of pride, greed, avarice. The fallen angels are spiritual beings, but spiritual beings who are motivated by pride and by greed and by envy and by avarice. Now, these are forces in the world today. We could say these angels as kind of fallen angels as kind of personifications of them, but it's an archetypal struggle that's been going on for a long time, and it's going on a more epic scale at the moment. And I feel that the angels can help us, and I pray and ask for Michael's help. I pray to God, and I pray on a regular basis. I think prayer is an essential part of helping us become aware of a larger connection, the fact we're not alone, the fact we're part of a much larger process. And that, personally, I find empowering. I find it something that helps me go on, even when I'm often attacked, as Matthew Fox has often been attacked too. I mean, you started by talking, Gary, about how heretics all through history have been attacked. Well, anyone who goes against the established order will get that response. But you can be crushed by it, defeated by it, or you can feel yourself a victim. But that's disempowering. To be able to go on requires the sense that one's part of a larger struggle, part of a larger process. And for me, an awareness of God and the angels and the saints is part of the process that empowers me and helps me.
I appreciate that. Thank you both very much for all your good work. The Physics of Angels, Exploring the Realm Where Science and Spirit Meet, from Dr. Rupert Sheldrake and Reverend Matthew Fox. I appreciate both of you being on today with our Progressive Commentary Hour, Conversation with Remarkable Minds. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.